Thick lashes lay against her cheeks. Her lips were slightly parted. A sheet was pulled up to her shoulders. Her clasped hands lay on it, above the swell of her bosom. A snatch of poetry, something from 12th grade English, came to mind and chimed there. Thy hyacinth hair, thy classic face, how statue-like I see thee. Jenny Knowlton stood beside the now useless ventilator, wringing her hands. Lightning flashed. In its momentary glare, I saw the iron pole on Sky Top, standing as it had for God knew how many years, challenging each storm to do its worst. Jacobs was holding out the box.
Help me, Jamie. We must be swift. Take it and open it. I'll do the rest.
Don't, Jenny said from her corner. For the love of God, let her rest in peace. Jacobs might not have heard her over the drumming rain and screaming wind. I did, but chose to ignore her. This is how we bring about our own damnation, you know, by ignoring the voice that begs us to stop while there's still time. I opened the box. There were no rods inside and no control box. What had taken their place was a metallic headband, as thin as the strap on a young girl's dress shoe. Jacobs took it out carefully, reverently, and gently pulled it. I saw it stretch, and when the next stroke of lightning came, once more preceded by that faint, clicking sound, I saw green radiance dance across it, making it look like something other than dead metal. A snake, maybe. Jacob said, Miss Knowlton, lift her head for me. She shook her head so hard her hair flew. He sighed, Jamie, you do it. I moved to the bed like a man in a dream. I thought of Patricia Farmingdale pouring salt in her eyes, of Emil Klein eating dirt, of Hugh Yates watching as the faithful in Pastor Danny's revival tent were replaced by huge ants. I thought, every cure has its price. There was another click, followed by another flash of lightning. Thunder roared, shaking the house. The bedside lamp went out. For a moment the room was plunged into shadows, and then a generator clattered to life.
Quickly!
Jacob's voice was pained. I saw burns across both his palms, but he hadn't dropped the headband. It was his last conductor, his conduit to Potestas Magnum Universum. And I believed then, and now, that not even death by electrocution would have made him drop it.
Quickly, before lightning strikes the pole!
I lifted Mary Fay's head. Her chestnut hair fell away from that perfect and perfectly still face in a dark flood that pooled on the pillow. Charlie was beside me, bending down and breathing in harsh, excited gasps. His exultation stank of age and infirmity. It occurred to me that he could have waited a few months and investigated what lay on the other side of the door personally, but that, of course, wasn't what he wanted. At the heart of every established religion is one sacred mystery that supports belief and induces fidelity, even to the point of martyrdom. Did he want to know what lay beyond death's door? Yes. But what he wanted more, I believe this with all my heart, was to violate that mystery, to drag it into the light and hold it up, screaming, "Here it is! What all your crusades and murder in the name of God were for, here it is, and how do you like it?"
Her hair. Lift her hair.
He turned accusingly to the woman cowering in the corner.
Damn you, I said, cut it.
Jenny made no reply. I lifted Mary Fay's hair. It was as soft and heavy as a bolt of silk, and I knew why Jenny hadn't cut it. She couldn't bear to. Jacob slipped the thin band of metal over her forehead so it lay tight against the hollows of her temples.
All right,
he said, straightening up. I laid the dead woman's head gently back on the pillow, and as I looked at those dark lashes brushing against her cheeks, a comforting thought came to me. It wouldn't work. Cures were one thing. Reviving a woman who had been dead for 15 minutes? No, closer to half an hour now, was another. It simply wasn't possible. And if a stroke of lightning packing millions of volts did do something, if it caused her to twitch her fingers or turn her head, It would be no more meaningful than the jerk of a dead frog's leg when electricity from a dry cell is applied. What could he hope to accomplish? Even if her brain had been perfectly healthy, it would now be decaying in her skull. Brain death is irrevocable. Even I knew that. I stepped back. Now what, Charlie?
We wait, he said. It won't be long.
When the bedside lamp went out a second time, 30 seconds or so later, it didn't come back on, and I could no longer hear the roar of the jenny below the roar of the wind. Now that he had slipped the metal band around Mary Fay's head, Jacob seemed to have lost interest in her. He was staring out the window, hands clasped behind his back like a ship's captain on a bridge. The iron pole wasn't visible through the teeming rain, not even as a shadow. But we'd see it when the lightning struck it, if the lightning struck it. So far, it hadn't. Perhaps there is a God, I thought, and he's taken sides against Charles Jacobs. Where's the control box? I asked him. Where's the connection to that pole out there?
He looked at me as if I were an imbecile. There's no way to control the power that lies beyond the lightning. It would fry even a titanium box to a cinder. As for the connection, it's you, Jamie. Haven't you guessed even yet why you're here? Did you think I brought you to cook my meals?
Once he'd said it, I couldn't understand why I hadn't seen it before, why it had taken me so long. The secret electricity had never really left me, or any of the people Bastard Danny had cured. Sometimes it slept, like the disease that had hidden so long in Mary Fay's brain. Sometimes it awoke and made you eat dirt, or pour salt in your eyes, or hang yourself with your pants. That small doorway needed 2 keys to unlock it. Mary Fay was one. I was the other.
Charlie, you have to stop this.
Stop? Are you insane?
No, I thought. That would be you. I've come to my senses. I just hoped it wasn't too late. There's something waiting on the other side. Astrid called it Mother. I don't think you want to see her, and I know I don't.
I bent to strip off the metal circlet that lay across Mary Fay's brow. He grabbed me in a bear hug and pulled me away. His arms were scrawny, and I should have been able to break his grip, but I couldn't, at least not at first. He held me with all the strength of his obsession. As we struggled away in that gloomy, shadow-haunted room, the wind suddenly dropped. The rain slackened. Through the window I could see the pole again, and small rivers of water running down the wrinkles in the bulging forehead of granite that was Skytop.
Thank God, I thought. The storm is passing by.
I stopped fighting him just as I was on the verge of breaking free, and so lost my chance to end that day's abomination before it could begin. The storm wasn't over. It had only been drawing in a breath before commencing its main assault. The wind rushed back, this time at hurricane velocity, and in the split-second interval before the lightning came, I felt what I had on the day I'd come here with Astrid. The stiffening of all the hair on my body, and the sense that the air in the room had turned to oil. Not a click this time, but a snap. As loud as a small-caliber gunshot, Jenny screamed in terror. A jagged branch of fire shot from the clouds and struck the iron pole and Skytop, turning it blue. My head was filled with a vast choir of shrieking voices, and I understood it was everyone Charles Jacobs had ever cured, plus everyone he'd ever snapped with his portraits and lightning camera. Not just the ones who'd suffered after effects. All of them, in their thousands. If that shrieking had gone on for even 10 seconds, it would have driven me insane. But as the electric fire coating the pole faded, leaving it to glow a dull cherry red, like a branding iron fresh from the fire, those agonized voices also faded away. Thunder rolled, and rain swooshed down in a rush, accompanied by a rattle of hail.
Oh, my God! Jenny screamed. Oh, my God! Look at it!
The circlet around Mary Fay's head was glowing a brilliant, pulsing green. I saw it with more than my eyes. It was deep in my brain as well, because I was the connection. I was the conduit. The glow began to fade, and then a fresh bolt of lightning struck the pole. The choir shrieked again, This time the band passed from green into a coruscating white, too dazzling to look at. I closed my eyes and put my hands over my ears. In the darkness, the after image of the circlet remained, now an ethereal blue. The interior screams faded. I opened my eyes and saw the glow embedded in the circlet was fading as well. Jacobs was staring at the corpse of Mary Fay with wide, fascinated eyes. Drool dripped from the frozen side of his mouth. The hail gave a final, furious rattle, then quit. The rain began to slacken. I saw lightning fork into the trees beyond Skytop, but the storm was already moving east. Jenny abruptly bolted from the room, leaving the door open. I heard her crash into something as she crossed to the living room, and the bang on the door to the outside, the one I had to struggle to close, flew open and hit the wall. She was gone. Jacobs took no notice. He bent over the dead woman, who lay with her eyes shut and her sooty lashes brushing her cheeks. The circlet was only dead metal now. In the shadowy room, it didn't even gleam. If it had burned her forehead, the mark was beneath the band. I didn't think it had. I would have smelled charred flesh. "Wake up," Jacob said. When there was no response, he shouted it. "Wake up!" He shook her arm, gently at first, then harder. "Wake up! Wake up, damn you! Wake up!" Her head wagged from side to side as he shook her, as if in negation. "Wake up, you bitch! Wake up!" He was going to pull her out of bed and onto the floor if he didn't stop, and I couldn't have borne that further desecration. I grabbed his right shoulder and hauled him away. We staggered backward in an awkward dance and crashed into the bureau. He turned on me, his face wild with fury and frustration. "Let me go! Let me go! I saved your miserable, useless life, and I demand you!" Then something happened. From the bed came a low humming sound. I relaxed my grip on Jacob's. The corpse lay as it had lain, only now with its hands splayed out at its sides, thanks to Charlie's shaking. "It was just the wind," I thought. I'm sure I could have convinced myself of it given time, but before I could even get started, it came again, a faint humming from the woman on the bed. "She's returning," Charlie said. His eyes were huge, bulging from their sockets like the eyes of a toad squeezed by a cruel child. "She's reviving. She's alive." "No," I said. If he heard, he paid no mind. All of his attention was fixed on the woman in the bed, the pale oval of her face deep in the swimming shadows that infested the room. He lurched toward her like Ahab on the deck of the Pequod, dragging his bad leg. His tongue lapped at his mouth on the side that wasn't frozen. He was gasping for breath.
"Mary," he said. "Mary Fay."
The humming sound came again, low and tuneless. Her eyes remained shut, but I realized with a cold chill of horror that I could see them moving beneath the lids, as if in death she dreamed.
"Do you hear me?"
His voice, dry with an almost prurient eagerness.
"If you hear me, give me a sign."
The humming continued. Jacobs put the palm of his hand on her left breast, then turned to me. Incredibly, he was grinning. In the gloom, he looked like a death's head.
"No heartbeat," he said. "Yet, she lives. She lives."
"No," I thought. "She waits. But the wait is almost over." Jacobs turned back to her and lowered his half-frozen face until it was only inches from her dead one, a Romeo with his Juliet.
"Mary, Mary Fay, come back to us. Come back and tell us where you've been."
It's hard for me to think of what happened next, let alone write it down, but I must, if only as a warning for anyone else who contemplates some similar experiment in damnation and may read these words and turn back because of them. She opened her eyes. Mary Fay opened her eyes. But they were no longer human eyes. Lightning had smashed the lock on a door that was never supposed to be opened. And Mother came through, They were blue eyes at first, bright blue. There was nothing in them. They were utterly blank. They stared at the ceiling through Jacob's avid face, and through the ceiling, and through the cloudy sky beyond. Then they came back. They registered him, and some understanding, some comprehension came into them. She made that humming sound again, but I hadn't seen her draw a single breath. What need? She was a dead thing, except for those inhuman, staring eyes.
"Where have you been, Mary Fay?"
His voice trembled. Saliva continued to drip from the bad side of his mouth, leaving damp spots on the sheet.
"Where have you been? What did you see there? What waits beyond death? What's on the other side? Tell me."
Her head began to pulse, as if the dead brain within had grown too big for his casing. Her eyes began to darken, first to lavender, then to purple, then to indigo. Her lips drew back in a smile that widened and became a grin. It grew until I could see all her teeth. One of her hands trundled across the counterpane, spider-like, and seized Jacob's wrist. He gasped at her cold grip and flailed for balance with his free hand. I took it, and thus the three of us, two living, one dead, were joined. Her head pulsed on the pillow, growing, bloating. She was no longer beautiful. She was no longer even human. The room didn't fade. It was still there. But I saw it was an illusion. The cottage was an illusion, and Skytop and the resort, the whole living world, was an illusion. What I thought of as reality was nothing but a scrim, as flimsy as an old nylon stocking. The true world was behind it. Basalt blocks rose to a black sky, punched with howling stars. I think those blocks were all that remained of a vast, ruined city. It stood in a barren landscape. Barren, yes, but not empty. A wide and seemingly endless column of naked human beings trudged through it, heads down, feet stumbling. This nightmare parade stretched all the way to the distant horizon. Driving the humans were ant-like creatures, most black, some the dark red of Venus blood. When humans fell, the ant things would lunge at them, biting and butting until they gained their feet again. I saw young men and old women. I saw teenagers with babies in their arms. I saw children trying to help each other along. And on every face was the same expression of blank horror. They marched beneath the howling stars. They fell. They were punished and chivied to their feet with gaping but bloodless bite wounds on their arms and legs and abdomens. Bloodless because these were the dead. The foolish mirage of earthly life had been torn away, and instead of the heaven preachers of all persuasions promised, what awaited them was a dead city of cyclopean stone blocks below a sky that was itself a scrim. The howling stars weren't stars at all. They were holes, and the howls emerging from them came from the true potestas magnum universum. Beyond the sky were entities. They were alive and all-powerful and totally insane. The after-effects are trailing fragments of an unknown existence beyond our lives, Charlie had said. And that existence lay close in this sterile place, a prismatic world of insane truth that would drive a man or woman mad if it were so much as glimpsed. The ant things served those great entities, just as the marching naked dead served the ant things. Perhaps the city wasn't a city at all, but a kind of anthill, where all the dead of Earth were first enslaved and then eaten. And once that happened, did they finally die for good? Perhaps not. I didn't want to remember the couplet Bree had quoted in her email, but was helpless not to. That is not dead which can eternal lie, and with strange eons, even death may die. Somewhere in that marching horde were Patsy Jacobs and Tagalong Maury. Somewhere in it was Claire, who deserved heaven and had gotten this instead. A sterile world below hollow stars, a charnel kingdom where guardian ant things sometimes crawled and sometimes stood upright, their faces hideously suggestive of the human. This horror was the afterlife, and it was waiting not just for the evil ones among us, but for us all. My mind began to totter. It was a relief, and I almost let go. One idea saved my sanity, and I still cling to it. The possibility that this nightmare landscape was itself a mirage. "No!" I shouted. The marching dead turned toward my voice. The ant things did likewise, their mandibles gnashing, their loathsome eyes, loathsome but intelligent, glaring. Overhead, the sky began to tear open with a titanic ripping sound. An enormous black leg, covered with tufts of spiny fur, pushed through it. The leg ended in a vast claw made of human faces. Its owner wanted one thing and one thing only, to silence the voice of negation. It was Mother. "No!" I shouted again. "No! No! No! No!" It was our connection to the revived dead woman that was causing this vision. Even in the extremity of my horror, I knew it. Jacobs's hand clutched mine like a manacle. If it had been the right hand, the good hand, I could never have freed myself in time. But it was the weakened left. I pulled with all my might as that obscene leg stretched toward me and that claw of screaming faces groped, meaning to yank me upward into the unknowable universe of horror that awaited beyond that black paper sky. Now, through the rip in the firmament, I could see. Insane light and colors never meant to be looked upon by mortal creatures. The colors were alive. I could feel them crawling over me. I gave one final yank, freeing myself from Charlie's grip, and went tumbling backward. The empty plain, the vast, broken city, the groping claw, they all disappeared. I was in the bedroom of the cottage again, sprawled on the floor. My old fifth business stood beside the bed. Mary Fay, or whatever dark creature Jacobs's secret electricity had summoned into her corpse and dead brain, gripped his hand. Her head had become a pulsing jellyfish, with a human face crudely scrawled upon it. Her eyes were a lusterless black. Her grin... You would say no one can actually grin ear to ear, and it's just a saying, but the dead woman who was no longer dead was doing exactly that. The lower half of her face had become a black pit that trembled and throbbed. Jacobs stared at her with bulging eyes. His face had gone a cheesy yellow-white.
"Patricia, Patsy, where are you? Where's Maury?"
The thing spoke for the first and last time. "Gone to serve the great ones in the null. No death. No light, no rest."
"No!"
His chest hitched and he screamed it.
"No!"
He tried to pull back. She, it, held him fast. Now from the dead woman's gaping mouth came a black leg with a flexing claw at the end of it. The claw was alive. It was a face, one I recognized. It was Tagalong Maury, and he was screaming. I heard a tenebrous rustling sound as the leg passed between her lips. In my nightmares, I still hear it. It reached. It stretched. It touched a sheet and scrabbled there like skinless fingers, leaving scorch marks that gave off thin tendrils of smoke. The black eyes of the thing that had been Mary Fay were bulging and spreading. They merged over the bridge of the nose and became a single enormous orb that stared with blank avidity. Charlie's head snapped back and he began to make a gargling sound. He stood on his toes, seeming to make one final galvanic effort to free himself from the grasping hand of the thing that was trying to come through from that insane netherworld I now know is so close to our own. Then he collapsed to his knees and fell forward with his forehead against the bed. He looked like he was praying. The thing let go of him and turned its unspeakable attention to me. It threw back the sheet and struggled to rise, that black insect's leg still extruding from its gaping maw of a mouth. Now Patsy's face had joined Maury's. They were melted together, writhing. I got up by pressing my back against the wall and pushing with my legs. Mary Fay's bloated, pulsing face was darkening, as if she were strangling on the thing inside her. That one smooth black eye stared, and reflected in it, I fancied I could see the Cyclopean city and the endless column of the marching dead. I don't remember yanking open the top drawer of the bureau. I only know that all at once the gun was in my hand. I believe if it had been an automatic with the safety on, I would have just stood there, pulling at the frozen trigger, until the thing arose, shambled across the room, and seized me. That claw would have pulled me into its gaping mouth and into that other world, where I would face some unspeakable punishment for daring to say one word. No. But it wasn't an automatic. It was a revolver. I fired 5 times, and 4 of the bullets went into the thing trying to rise from Mary Fay's deathbed. I have reason to know exactly how many shots I fired. I heard the roar of the gun and saw repeated muzzle flashes into the gloom, felt it jump in my hand, but all of that seemed to be happening to someone else. The thing flailed and fell back. The melted faces screamed with mouths that had merged. I remember thinking, "You can't kill Mother with bullets, Jamie." No, not her. But it was no longer moving. The obscenity that had come out of its mouth lay limp, trailing on the pillow. The faces of Jacob's wife and son were fading. I covered my eyes and screamed over and over again. I screamed until I was hoarse. When I lowered my hands, the claw was gone. Mother was gone, too. "If she was ever there in the first place," I hear you say, and I don't blame you. I wouldn't have believed it myself if I hadn't been there. But I was. They were. The dead ones. And she was. Now, however, it was only Mary Fay, a woman whose serenity in death had been destroyed by 4 bullets fired into her corpse. She lay askew with her hair fanned out around her head and her mouth hanging open. I could see 2 bullet holes in her nightgown and 2 more below them in the sheet that was now puddled around her hips. I could also see the scorch marks left by that terrible claw, although there was no other sign of it now. Jacobs began very slowly to slide to his left. I reached out, but the movement felt slow and dreamy. I didn't even come close to grabbing him. He thumped to the floor on his side, knees still bent. His eyes were wide open, but already glazing. An unutterable expression of horror was stamped on his features. "Charlie, you look like a man who just got a bad electrical shock," I thought, and began to laugh. Oh, how I did laugh. I bent over, grasping my knees to keep from falling. It was almost noiseless, that laughter. The screaming had blown my voice out, but it was genuine, because it was funny. You see that, don't you? Bad electrical shock. A shocking development. Hilarious. But all the time I was laughing, convulsed with it, sick with it. I kept my eyes on Mary Fay, waiting for the hair-tufted black leg to slither out of her mouth again, giving birth to those screaming faces. At last, I staggered out of the death chamber and through the living room. A few broken branches lay on the carpet, blown through the door Jenny Knowlton had left open. They crunched like bones under my feet, and I wanted to scream again, but I was too tired. Oh, I was so tired. The stacked storm clouds were moving away to the east, throwing down random forks of lightning as they went. Soon the streets of Brunswick and Freeport would be flooded, the storm drains temporarily clogged with chips of hail. But between those dark clouds and the place where I stood, a rainbow bent its many-colored arc over the entire breadth of Androscoggin County. Hadn't there been rainbows on the day Astrid and I had come here? God gave Noah the rainbow sign we used to sing during our Thursday night MYF meetings, while Patsy Jacobs swayed on the piano bench and her ponytail swung from side to side. A rainbow was supposed to be a good sign. It meant the storm was over. But looking at this one filled me with fresh horror and revulsion, because it reminded me of Hugh Yates. Hugh and his prismatics. Hugh, who had also seen the ant things. The world began to darken. I realized I was on the verge of fainting. And that was good. Perhaps when I woke up, my mind would have blotted all this out. That would be even better. Even madness would be better. As long as there was no mother in it. Death would be best of all. Robert Rivard had known it. Kathy Morse had, too. I remembered the revolver then. Surely there was a bullet left in it for me. But it seemed like no solution. Perhaps it would have, if I hadn't heard what Mother said to Jacobs. No death, no light, no rest. Only the great ones, she had said. In the null. My knees unhinged, and I went down, leaning against the side of the doorway, and that was where I blacked out. Chapter 14. After Effects. Those things happened 3 years ago. Now I live in Kailua, not far from my brother Conrad. It's a pretty coastal town on the Big Island. My place is on Oneiva Street, a neighborhood quite distant from the beach and an even longer stretch from fashionable, but the apartment is spacious and, for Hawaii at least, cheap. Also, it's close to Ku'ulie Road, and that's an important consideration. The Brandon L. Martin Psychiatric Center is on Ku'ulie Road, and that's where my psychiatrist hangs out his shingle. Edward Braithwaite says he's 41, but to me he looks like he's 30. I found that when you're 61, an age I will reach this August, every man and woman between the ages of 25 and 45 appears to be 30. It's hard to take people seriously when they look as if they're barely past their terrible 20s. It is for me, anyway. But I try hard with Braithwaite, because he's done me quite a lot of good. Although I'd have to say that the antidepressants have done more. I know that some people don't like them. They claim the pills muffle both their thinking and their emotions, and I can testify that they do. Thank God they do. I connected with Ed thanks to Con, who gave up the guitar for athletics and gave up athletics for astronomy, although he's still a volleyball monster and not bad on the tennis court either. I've told Dr. Braithwaite everything you've read in these pages. I held back nothing. He doesn't believe much of it, of course, who in his right mind would. But what a relief in the telling. And certain elements of the story have given him pause, because they are verifiable. Pastor Danny, for instance. Even now, a Google search for that name will yield almost 1 million results. Check it yourself if you don't believe me. Whether or not any of his cures were genuine remains a matter of debate, but that's true even of Pope John Paul, who supposedly cured a French nun of Parkinson's while alive, and a Costa Rican woman of an aneurysm 6 years after he died. A good trick. What happened to many of Charlie's cures, what they did to themselves, and what they did to others, is also a matter of fact rather than of conjecture. Ed Braithwaite believes I wove those facts into my narrative to give them verisimilitude. He almost said as much one day last year when he quoted Jung to me. The world's most brilliant confabulators are in asylums. I'm not in an asylum. When I finish my sessions at Martin Psychiatric, I'm free to leave and go back to my silent, sunny apartment. For this, I am grateful. I'm also grateful to still be alive, because many of Pastor Danny's cures are not. Between the summer of 2014 and the fall of 2015, they committed suicide by the dozens, perhaps by the hundreds. It's hard to be sure. I'm helpless not to imagine them reawakening in that other world, marching naked beneath the howling stars, harried along by terrible ant soldiers, and I'm very glad I'm not among them. I think that gratitude for life, whatever the cause, indicates that one has managed to hold on to the core of one's sanity. That some of my sanity is gone forever, amputated, like an arm or a leg, by what I saw in Mary Fay's death room, is a fact I've learned to live with. And for 50 minutes every Tuesday and Thursday, between 2 o'clock and 2:50, I talk. How I do talk. On the morning after the storm, I woke up on one of the couches in the lobby of the Goat Mountain Resort. My face hurt, and my bladder was bursting, but I had no desire to relieve myself in the men's room across from the restaurant. There were mirrors in there, and I didn't want to glimpse my reflection, even by accident. I went outside to piss, and saw one of the resort's golf carts crashed into the porch steps. There was blood on the seat and the rudimentary dashboard. I looked down at my shirt and saw more blood. When I wiped my swollen nose, a maroon crust flaked off on my finger. So I had driven the golf cart and crashed it and bumped my face, although I could remember doing none of that. To say I didn't want to go back to the cottage near Skytop would be the understatement of the century, but I had to. Getting into the golf cart was the easy part. Driving it back down the path through the woods was more difficult, and every time I had to stop and move fallen branches, it was harder to get going again. My nose was throbbing, and my head was thumping with a tension headache. The door was still standing open. I parked, got out of the cart, and at first could only stand there, rubbing at my poor swollen nose until it began to ooze blood again. The day was sunny and beautiful. The storm had washed away all the heat and humidity. But the room beyond that open door was a cave of shadows. "There's nothing to worry about," I told myself. "Nothing will happen. It's over." Only, what if it wasn't? What if the something was still happening? What if she was waiting for me, and ready to reach with that claw made of faces? I forced myself up the steps, one at a time, and when a crow cawed harshly from the woods behind me, I cringed and screamed and covered my head. The only thing that kept me from bolting was the knowledge that if I didn't see what was in there, Mary Fay's death room would haunt me for the rest of my life. There was no pulsing abomination with a single black eye. Charlie's patient Omega lay as she had when I last saw her, with 2 bullet holes in her nightgown and 2 more in the sheet around her hips. Her mouth was open, and although there was no sign of that horrible black extrusion, I didn't even try to tell myself I had imagined it all. I knew better. The metal band, now dull and dark, still circled her forehead. Jacob's position had changed. Instead of lying on his side next to the bed with his knees drawn up, he was propped in a sitting position on the other side of the room against the bureau. My first thought was that he hadn't been dead after all. The terror of what had happened in here had brought on another stroke, but not an immediately fatal one. He had come to, crawled as far as the bureau, and died there. It could have been, except for the revolver in his hand. I stared at it for a long time, frowning, trying to recall. I couldn't then, and I've refused Ed Braithwaite's offer to hypnotize me in an effort to recover my blocked memories. Partly, this is because I'm afraid of what hypnosis might release from the darker regions of my mind. Mostly, it's because I know what must have happened. I turned from Charlie's body. That expression of horror was still stamped on his face. To look at Mary Fay. I had fired the revolver 5 times, I was sure of that, but only 4 bullets had gone into her. 1 had gone wild, not surprising when you consider my state of mind. But when I lifted my eyes to the wall, I saw two bullet holes there. Had I gone back to the resort, then returned the previous evening? I suppose it was possible, but I didn't think I could have brought myself to do that, even in a blackout. No. I had fixed this scene before I left. Then I went back, crashed the golf cart, staggered up the steps, and fell asleep in the lobby. Charlie hadn't dragged himself across the room. I was the one who did the dragging. I propped him against the bureau, put the gun in his right hand, and fired it into the wall. The cops who would eventually discover this bizarre scene might not test Charlie's hand for gunshot residue, but if they did, they would find it. I wanted to cover Mary Fay's face, but everything had to be left exactly as it was, and what I wanted most of all was to escape that room of shadows. I took a moment longer, though. I knelt beside my old fifth business and touched one of his thin wrists. "You should have stopped, Charlie," I said. "You should have stopped a long time ago." But could he have done that? It'd be easy to say yes, because that would allow me to lay blame. Only I'd have to blame myself as well, because I hadn't stopped either. Curiosity is a terrible thing, but it's human. So human. I hadn't been there at all, I told Dr. Braithwaite. That's what I decided, and there was only one person who could testify that I had been. "The nurse," Ed said, "Jenny Knowlton. I thought she'd have no choice but to help me. We had to help each other, and the way to do it would be to say we'd left Goat Mountain together. When Jacob started raving about turning off Mary Fay's life support, I was sure Jenny would go along with that, if only to make certain I kept quiet about her part in it. I didn't have her cell number, but I knew Jacob's would. His address book was in the Cooper suite, and sure enough, her number was in it. I called and got voicemail. I told her to call me back. Astrid's number was also in the book, so I tried her next. And also got voicemail? Yes. I put my hands over my face. Astrid's days of answering her phone had been all over by then. Yes, that's right. Here's what happened. Jenny drove her golf cart back to the resort. Jenny got into her Subaru. Jenny drove to Mount Desert Island without stopping. All she wanted was the comfort of home. That meant Astrid, and sure enough, Astrid was waiting for her. Their bodies were found just inside the front door. Astrid must have plunged the butcher knife into her partner's throat as soon as Jenny walked in. Then she used it to cut her wrists. She did it crosswise, not the recommended technique, but she cut all the way to the bone. I imagine them lying there in pools of drying blood, while first Jenny's phone rang in her purse, then Astrid's on the kitchen counter below the knife rack. I don't want to imagine that, but I'm helpless to stop it. Not all of Jacob's curers killed themselves, but over the next 2 years, a great many did. Not all of them took loved ones with them, but over 50 did. This I know from my research, which I shared with Ed Braithwaite. He would like to write it off as coincidence. He can't quite do it, although he is happy to dispute my own conclusion from this parade of madness, suicide, and murder. Mother demands sacrifices. Patricia Farmingdale, the lady who poured salt in her eyes, recovered enough of her vision to smother her elderly father in his bed before blowing her brains out with her husband's Ruger. Emil Klein, the dirt eater, shot his wife and son, then went out to his garage, poured lawnmower gas over himself, and struck a match. Alice Adams, cured of cancer at a Cleveland revival, went into a convenience store with her boyfriend's AR-15 and unloaded, killing 3 random people. When the clip was empty, she pulled a snub-nosed .38 from her pocket and fired it into the roof of her mouth. Margaret Tremaine, one of Pastor Danny's San Diego cures, Crohn's disease, threw her infant son from the balcony of her 9th-story apartment, then followed him down. Witnesses said she uttered not a sound as she fell. Then there was Al Stamper. You probably know about him. How could you have missed the screaming headlines in the supermarket tabloids? He invited both of his ex-wives to dinner, but one of them, the second, I believe, got caught in traffic and showed up late, which was lucky for her. When she walked in the open door of Stamper's Westchester home, she discovered wife number one, roped to a chair at the dining room table with the top of her head caved in. The ex-lead singer of the Bolites emerged from the kitchen, brandishing a baseball bat slimed with blood and hair. Wife number two fled the house, screaming, with Stamper chasing after her. Halfway down the residential street, he fell to the pavement, dead of a heart attack. No surprise there. He was a heavyweight. I'm sure I didn't find all the cases, scattered across the country as they were, and buried in the outbreaks of senseless violence that seem more and more to be a part of daily life in America. Bree could have found others, but she wouldn't have helped me even if she'd still been single and living in Colorado. Bree Donlin Hughes wants nothing to do with me these days, and I totally get that. Shortly before Christmas last year, Hugh phoned Bree's mother and asked her to come up to his office at the big house. He said he had a surprise for her, and he certainly did. He strangled his old lover with a lamp cord, carried her body into the garage, and slipped her into the passenger seat of his vintage Lincoln Continental. Then he got behind the wheel, started the engine, got some rock on the radio, and sucked exhaust. Bree knows I promised to steer clear of Jacobs, and Bree knows I lied. Let us suppose it's all true, Ed Braithwaite said during one of our recent sessions. How daring of you, I said. He smiled, but stayed on point. It still wouldn't follow that the vision you saw of that hellish afterlife was a true vision. I know it still haunts you, Jamie, but consider all the people, not excluding John of Patmos, author of the Book of Revelation, who've had visions of heaven and hell. Old men, old women, even children claim to have peeked beyond the veil. Heaven is for real, is basically the afterlife vision of a kid who almost died when he was four. Colton Burpo, I said. I read it. He talks about a horsey only Jesus can ride. Make fun all you want, Braithwaite said, shrugging. Lord knows it's an easy account to make fun of. But Burpo also met a miscarried sister whom he knew nothing about. That's verifiable information, like all those murder-suicides. Many murder-suicides, but Colton only met one sister, I said. The difference is one of quantity. I never took a course in statistics, but I know that. I'm happy to assume the kid's vision of the afterlife was false, because it supports my thesis that your vision of it, the sterile city, the ant things, the black paper sky, was equally false. You see what I'm driving at, don't you? Yes, and I'd love to buy into it. Of course I would. Anyone would. Because every man and woman owes a death, and the thought of going to the place I saw has done more than cast a shadow over my life. It has made that life seem thin and unimportant. No, not just my life. Every life. So I hang on to one thought. It's my mantra. The first thing I tell myself in the morning, and the last thing I tell myself at night. Mother lied. Mother lied. Mother lied. Sometimes, I almost believe it. But there are reasons I can't quite manage to do so. There are signs. Before going back to Nederland, where I would discover that Hugh had killed himself after murdering Bree's mother, I drove to the home place in Harlow. There were two reasons for this. After Jacob's body was discovered, the police might get in touch with me and ask for an accounting of my time in Maine. That seemed important, although in the end they never did. But something else was more important. I needed the comfort of a familiar place and people who loved me. I didn't get it. You remember Carol Lynn, don't you? My great-niece, the one I carried around at the Labor Day party in 2013 until she fell asleep on my shoulder. the one who held out her arms to me every time I came near. When I walked into the house where I'd grown up, Carolyn was between her mother and dad, sitting in an old-fashioned high chair that I might have sat in once myself. When the little girl saw me, she began to scream and throw herself from side to side so violently that she would have tumbled to the floor if her dad hadn't caught her. She buried her face against his chest, still screeching at the top of her lungs. She only stopped when her grandfather Terry led me out onto the porch. "What the hell's that about?" he asked half-humorously. "Last time you were here, she couldn't get enough of you." "Don't know," I said. But of course I did. I had hoped to stay a night, perhaps two, sucking up normality the way a vampire sucks blood. But that wasn't going to work. I didn't know exactly what Carolyn sensed in me. But I never wanted to see her small, terrified face again. I told Terry I just stopped by to say hello. Couldn't even stay for supper. Had a plane to catch in Portland. "I'd been in Lewiston," I said. "Slop recording a band Norm Irving had told me about. He said he thought they had national potential."
"And do they?" he asked.
"Nah, strictly lo-fi." I made a business of looking at my watch.
"Never mind the plane," Terry said. "You can catch another one. Come on in and have dinner with the family, little brother. Carol will settle down."
I didn't think so. I told Terry I had recording gigs at Wolfjaw that I absolutely could not miss. I told him another time, and when he held out his arms to me, I hugged him hard, knowing chances were good, I'd never see him again. I didn't know about the murders and suicides then, but I knew I was carrying something poisonous and would probably carry it for the rest of my life. The last thing I wanted was to infect the people I loved. On the way back to my rental car, I stopped and looked at the dirt strip between the lawn and Methodist Road. The road had been paved for years, but the strip of dirt looked just as it had when I used to play there with the toy soldiers my sister gave me for my 6th birthday. I had been kneeling there and playing with them one day in the fall of 1962 when a shadow fell over me. That shadow is still there.
"Have you murdered anyone?"
Ed Braithwaite has asked me this question on several occasions. It is, I believe, what's called incremental repetition. I always smile and tell him no. It's true that I put 4 bullets into poor Mary Fay, but the woman was already dead at the time, and Charles Jacobs died of a final cataclysmic stroke. If it hadn't happened that day, it would have happened on another, and probably before the year was out. "And you obviously haven't committed suicide," Ed continues, smiling himself. "Unless I'm hallucinating you, that is."
"You're not."
"The impulse isn't there."
"No."
"Not even as a theoretical possibility. One that comes to you in the dead of night, perhaps, when you can't sleep."
"No."
"My life these days is far from happy, but the antidepressants have put a floor under me. Suicide isn't on my radar. And given what may come after death, I want to live as long as possible. There's something else, too. I feel, rightly or wrongly, that I have a lot to atone for. Because of that, I'm still trying to be a do-right daddy. I cook at the Harbor House Soup Kitchen in Aupopu Street. I volunteered 2 days a week at the Goodwill in Kaolu Drive, next to the Nene Goose Bakery. If you're dead, you can't atone for anything. Tell me, Jamie, why are you the special lemming who feels no urge to jump off the cliff? Why are you immune?" I just smile and shrug. I could tell him, but he wouldn't believe me. Mary Fay was Mother's door into our world, but I was the key. Shooting a corpse kills nothing. Not that an immortal being such as Mother can be killed, but when I fired that pistol, I locked the door. I said no with more than my mouth. If I told my shrink that some otherworldly being, one of the great ones, was saving me for some final and apocalyptic act of revenge because of that no, said shrink might begin thinking about involuntary committal. I don't want that, because I have another duty, one I consider far more important than helping out at Harbor House or sorting clothes at the Goodwill. At the end of each session with Ed, I pay his receptionist by check. I can afford to do this because the itinerant rock guitarist turned recording engineer is now a wealthy man. Ironic, isn't it? Hugh Yates died without issue and left a substantial fortune handed down from his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather behind. There were many small bequests, including gifts of cash to Malcolm, Mookie, MacDonald, and Hillary Katz, a.k.a. Pagan Starshine, but a large part of the estate was to be divided between me and Georgia Donlan. Given Georgia's death at Hughes's hands, that particular bequest could have provided probate attorneys with 20 years' worth of legal munching and tasty fees, but since there was no one to kick up Dickens, I certainly wasn't going to, there was no wrangle. Hughes' lawyers got in touch with Bree and told her that, as the deceased was her mother, she arguably had a valid claim on the loot. Only Bree wouldn't argue. The lawyer who handled my end of the business told me Bree claimed Hughes' money was tainted. Perhaps so, but I had no compunctions about taking my share of it, partly because I played no part in Hughes' cure, mostly because I consider myself tainted already, and feel it's better to be tainted in comfort than in poverty. I have no idea what happened to the several million that would have gone to Georgia, and have no desire to find out. Too much knowledge isn't good for a person. I know that now. When my twice-weekly session is finished and my bill is paid, I leave Ed Braithwaite's outer office. Beyond is a wide carpeted hall lined with other offices. A right turn would take me back to the lobby, and from the lobby to Koulier Road. But I don't turn right. I turn left. Finding Ed was just happenstance, you see. I originally came to the Brandon L. Martin Psychiatric Center on other business. I walk down the hallway, then cross the fragrant, beautifully maintained garden that is the green heart of this large facility. Here, patients sit, taking the reliable Hawaiian sun. Many are fully dressed. Some are in pajamas or nightgowns. A few, recent arrivals, I believe, wear hospital johnnies. Some engage in conversations, either with fellow patients or with unseen companions. Others merely sit, looking at the trees and flowers with vacant, drugged-to-the-gills stares. Two or three are accompanied by attendants, lest they hurt themselves or others. The attendants usually greet me by name as I pass. They know me well by now. On the other side of this open-air atrium is Cosgrove Hall, one of three Martin Center inpatient residences. The other two are for short-termers, mainly people with substance abuse problems. The usual stay in those is 28 days. Cosgrove is for people with issues that take longer to resolve, if they ever do. Like the corridor in the main building, the one in Cosgrove is wide and carpeted. Like the corridor in the main building, the air is chilled to perfection. But there are no pictures on the walls, and no Muzak either. Because in it, some of the patients hear voices murmuring obscenities or issuing sinister directives. In the main building's corridor, some of the doors are open. Here, all are shut. My brother, Conrad, has been residing in Cosgrove Hall for almost 2 years now. The Martin Center administrators and the psychiatrist in charge of his case want to move him to a more permanent facility. Aloha Village on Maui has been mentioned, but so far I have resisted. Here in Kailua, I can visit him after my appointments with Ed, and thanks to Hugh's generosity, I can afford his upkeep. Although I must admit my walks down the Cosgrove hallway are a trial. I try to make them with my eyes fixed on my feet. I can do that, because I know it's exactly 142 steps from the atrium doorway to Conn's small suite. I don't always succeed. Sometimes I hear a voice whispering my name, but mostly I do. You remember Conn's partner, don't you? The hunk from the University of Hawaii Botany Department? I didn't name him then and don't intend to now, although I might have done if he ever visited Connie. He doesn't, though.
If you asked him, I'm sure he'd say, why in God's name would I want to visit the man who tried to kill me? I can think of two reasons. One, Karn wasn't in his right mind, or in any mind at all, for that matter. After hitting the hunk over the head with a lamp, my brother ran into the bathroom, locked the door, and swallowed a handful of Valium tablets. A small handful. When Botany Boy came around, with a bloody scalp that needed stitches, but otherwise not much the worse for wear, he called 911. The police came and broke down the bathroom door. Khan was passed out and snoring in the tub. The EMTs examined him and didn't even bother to pump his stomach. Khan didn't try very hard to kill either Botany Boy or himself. That's the other reason. But of course, he was one of Jacob's first cures. Probably the first. On the day he left Harlow, Charlie told me that Khan had almost certainly cured himself. The rest had been a trick. Pure huggermugger. It's a skill they try to teach in divinity school, he'd said. I was always good at it. Only he lied. The cure was as real as Khan's current state of semi-catatonia. I know that now. I was the one Charlie conned. Not just once, but again and again and again. Still, count your blessings, right? Conrad Morton had a lot of good stargazing years before I woke Mother. And there's hope for him. He plays tennis, after all, although he never speaks. And as I said, he's a volleyball monster. His doctor says he's begun to show increased outward response, whatever that is when it's at home. And the nurses and orderlies are less likely to come in and see him standing in the corner and striking his head lightly against the wall. Ed Braithwaite says that in time, Conrad may come all the way back, that he may revive. I choose to believe he will. People say that where there's life, there's hope, and I have no quarrel with that. But I also believe the reverse. There is hope. Therefore, I live. Twice a week, after my talks with Ed, I sit in the living room of my brother's suite and talk some more. Some of what I tell him is real. A kerfuffle at Harbor House that brought the police. A particularly large haul of almost new clothes at the Goodwill. How I've finally gotten around to watching all 5 seasons of The Wire. And some of it is made up. Like the woman I'm supposedly seeing who works as a waitress at the Nene Goose Bakery. And the long Skype conversations I have with Terry. Our visits are monologues rather than conversations, and that makes fiction necessary. My real life just won't do, because these days it's as sparsely furnished as a cheap hotel room. I always finish by telling him he's too thin, he has to eat more, and by telling him that I love him. Do you love me, Con? I ask. So far, he hasn't answered. But sometimes he smiles a little. That's an answer of a kind. Wouldn't you agree? When 4 o'clock comes and our visit is over, I reverse course and walk back down to the atrium, where the shadows of the palms, the avocados, and the big twisted banyan at the center of it all have begun to grow long. I count my steps, and I take little glances at the door ahead of me, but otherwise keep my gaze firmly fixed on the carpet. Unless I hear that voice whispering my name. Sometimes when that happens, I'm able to ignore it. Sometimes I cannot. Sometimes I look up in spite of myself and see that the hospital wall, painted soothing pastel yellow, has been replaced with gray stones held together by ancient mortar and covered with ivy. The ivy is dead. And the branches look like grasping skeletal hands. The small door in the wall is hidden. Astrid was right about that. But it's there. The voice comes from behind it, drifting through an ancient, rusty keyhole. I walk on resolutely. Of course I do. Horrors beyond comprehension wait on the other side of that door. Not just the land of death, but the land beyond death. A place full of insane colors, mad geometry, and bottomless chasms where the great ones live their endless, alien lives and think their endless,
malevolent thoughts. It's the null beyond that door. I walk on and think of the couplet in Bree's last email. That is not dead, which can eternal lie, and with strange eons, even death may die.
Jamie,
an old woman's voice whispers from the keyhole of a door only I can see.
Come. Come to me and live forever.
No, I tell her, just as I told her in my vision. No. And, so far, so good. But eventually something will happen. Something always does. And when it does, I will come to Mother. April 6th, 2013 to December 27th, 2013.
Revival was written by Stephen King and read by David Morse. It was recorded at Philadelphia Post by Steve Campagna. Editing and post-production by Mike Ticino for Common Mode. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Michael Noble. Revival was produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Revival is available in print from Scribner. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Stephen King's Mr. Mercedes and Dr. Sleep, both read by Will Patton.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.